check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
The news slaps us in the face. 1% of humans will control more than half the wealth of the world. This is the result of what author David Bollier calls the market state. It's that tight marriage of billionaires, megacorporations, and our former democratic institutions. A host of problems boil out of this paradigm of power, including climate change. We've been told there is no alternative. David Bollier says there is. And it's an idea we've been taught almost to hate, the commons. His most recent book is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons, whatever that is. It's one of those twisty ideas, the deeper you look, the deeper it gets. David has been at this for 15 years as an independent scholar, blogger, and writer. David Bollier, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here.
Well, I often like to define a few terms, David, and lay out what we're going to talk about, but this time I think because of the topic, that's a bad idea. Can we start instead with a couple of examples of things that work like a commons?
Well, the commons can be broadly understood as everything that we share and own together, and it can be as broad as the atmosphere and the oceans, public lands, public research that the government does, to things that are really socially driven, such as online communities or open source software or Wikipedia. There's all sorts of urban commons where people get together to manage public spaces or community gardens. So it has to be understood as not just a thing or resource, but as a social paradigm, a social system for managing collective resources.
Okay, so could you give me just one concrete example?
I gave you several there, like Wikipedia and open source software are maybe for the digital crowd very familiar ones, but other ones would be national parks or federal research for drug research, which is then handed over virtually for free to the drug industry. And then there's things like the standards or protocols that allow the internet to function. So those protocols are kind of a shared way of managing all this digital traffic. You could say that the internet is a great hosting infrastructure for creating commons. So it's really, the commons is kind of a way of looking at and perceiving different types of resources in a way that's different from the standard economic market approach to them.
And yet, there is a political party in the United States and in many countries dedicated to privatizing everything, including prisons, hospitals, and schools. Talk to us about the forces working against the commons.
Well, that's just it. You can't talk about the commons without talking about the so-called enclosure of the commons. An enclosure is a process of privatizing and commoditizing these shared resources. In other words, turning them into input for the market, so that the gains from the market transactions can be privatized. And that's really, I think, the great unacknowledged scandal of our time, that vast quantities of our shared resources are being enclosed. And, this goes to the human genome, one-fifth of which is now privately owned through patents, to all sorts of intellectual property where people claim ownership of words and phrases, to the extension of copyright. So enclosure is this really quite pervasive phenomena in much of global capitalism to take over these free resources and put them to purpose for private market gain.
Well, and another problem we have is our indoctrination. Most of us learn two things in school. The communes all failed and communism is horrible. David, do you think the multiple failures of the Soviet Union set back communalism for a generation or more?
Well, I think in the United States, people are really, it's taboo to talk about collective things because the great bugaboo has been communism for so long. But it's important to understand that communism was about the government collectively organizing these things, whereas the commons is, in its standard state, self-organized, voluntary organizing of these things. Sometimes the resources are so large the government has to get involved. But let's just say that the commons is quite distinct from communism.
So then we have the meme that the commons is a tragedy. Where did that come from?
Well, there was a famous 1968 essay by this biologist named Garrett Hardin who wrote an essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. And basically it was kind of this parable that he said, imagine you have a pasture and everybody can put as many cattle as they want on that pasture as they want. What will happen to it? It will be overexploited and ruined. This is the so-called tragedy of the commons. He claimed that none of the people would have a rational individual reason for withholding. But this is just not empirical in the sense of, yes, people do overuse shared resources, but it's also true that people in real-life circumstances tend to talk to each other and negotiate a set of rules for preventing the overexploitation of a shared resource. And this is, in fact, what Eleanor Ostrom, a woman who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009, discovered, that all sorts of people from forest and fisheries and farmland and irrigation water are perfectly capable of collectively negotiating rules for managing those shared resources so they don't get overexploited and depleted. So the tragedy of the commons is, in a sense, a smear against the idea of group governance of a resource. And it's also been quite useful to conservatives and free market ideologues who like to say that the only solution is private property and markets, and that collective management of a resource will always fail, which is just not true.
Now, in my early life, I was part of the Back to the Land movement. In the 1960s and 70s, I gobbled up the book Heavens on Earth, Utopian Communities in America, 1680 to 1880 by Mark Holloway. It's still a classic worth a read. And it was a revelation to me that America has a history of communes. What happened to them?
Well, I'm not an expert on communes, and I'm sure that's a very complex story. But I also think that there probably was all sorts of reasons that they couldn't be financially self-sustaining, and they put too much effort on certain individual members. And there are a lot of commons that continue to work, I should add. But I think that the challenge for most commons, speaking generally, is how you manage collective action problems, meaning how do you manage free riders or cheaters or people who overexploit. And any successful commons develops rules and institutional systems for dealing with that. And it's quite possible that the communes of the 60s and 70s didn't do that because that's a standard way for commons to fail, to not have the systems to prevent the people from unfairly taking advantage of the group.
All right. Now, there is more communal idealism, David, outside the United States, for example, in Europe. And then you say up to 2 billion people depend on some form of the commons to survive. Just briefly tell us about them.
Well, I think that because we see the so-called global South through the prism of standard economics, we tend not to see that all sorts of traditional communities, indigenous peoples, and many others, as villages, as communities, as groups of farmers, as groups of fishermen, manage those resources as commons. And these, I might add that these commoners are doing it for their everyday subsistence and not necessarily for the market. So right there, it goes under the radar screen of most standard economics who, after all, are looking for market transactions as a sign of something significant going on. Whereas any commons, there's not usually market transactions, and so it's not even seen by economics, or it's regarded as marginal or not significant. But as I say, there's an estimated 2 billion people who depend in their everyday lives for water, forest products, fisheries, farmland, and the like for their everyday needs.
You know, I'm getting the idea that I'm really limited by my own idea. I started out thinking about communes, you know, the Amish, the Hutterites, the Mormons, perhaps native reserves. But you're talking about something much bigger than that. And it's not necessarily about just going to a piece of land and living separately from everybody else. It's doing something together.
Well, precisely. And I think that the truth is that there are commons all around us that we don't necessarily recognize as such. Or, you know, for example, the the countless numbers of online communities that we participate in as giving members and as people who receive benefits from them. That's the commons. And one purpose of talking about the commons is to start to recognize that there's an entire class of phenomena of important economic activity and social enjoyment that occurs through commons, and therefore we need to be able to protect those commons from being converted into just market resources. So that's part of what the commons is all about, is recognizing the valuable things that occur through this collective management and how socially satisfying it can be.
Well, in a way, this radio program is part of the commons because we're going out over nonprofit radio stations, community-owned radio stations. So there's an example where the airwaves have kind of been grabbed back by the people and used for our own purposes.
Absolutely. The only refinement I would put on that is that in a classic commons, there's generally a bottom-up, self-organizing dynamic at work in which people make the rules by which they're going to be governed, as opposed to top-down hierarchies dictating that even for nonprofit purposes. So the commons, in more classic terms, is about self-governance and democracy in ways that we determine ourselves. And so in some ways it's taking the focus of democracy from just electoral politics and government and bringing it down to self-provisioning in all sorts of ways. And, you know, this is about really reclaiming a certain sense of control and sovereignty from the dependence that the market likes to get us roped into. So it's a very broad territory to talk about, far more than just communal activity.
Well, David Bollier, didn't humans evolve as a communal species? Is that kind of hardwired into us?
Well, you know, if you talk to evolutionary scientists, they say that this is really kind of the default mode of human beings organizing themselves, and that the whole idea of the self-made man as an individual and of Homo economicus that economists talk about, the utility-maximizing selfish individual, these are historical aberrations that have only existed in the past couple hundred years, but that historically the human race has found all sorts of collaborative means to advance its welfare in groups, and that the commons is really more the default than the market.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest David Bollier. We're talking about an alternative to super-individualism and to capitalism. David's new book is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. I have so many questions. Do people form a commons when they're poor but leave when they get more money? And why don't millions of poor Americans form a commons when hundreds of millions of very poor people in developing countries do?
Well, you raise a great number of questions. But in fact, right now in Greece, which is in the vanguard of austerity politics, they've been at the forefront of developing a lot of these collective solutions that are both commons-based, and they're also using a lot of so-called peer production techniques, digital online communities, to meet survival needs. I think in American history, we have all sorts of these examples from the progressive movement and cooperatives, for example, but many of these have been papered over or forgotten, or one might say deliberately suppressed by the whole economics discipline, which really I think is intellectually, if not ideologically, opposed to the very idea of certain collective solutions. So there are many, many examples out there, both emerging that are being created, as well as ones from history.
And you've said the commons is both a cause and a possible solution for climate change. Could you elaborate on that, David?
Well, I don't believe that any top-down solution that is forced on people is going to work very well because it won't have their consent or participation, let alone the innovation they could bring to it. And therefore, it won't reach to the levels and the changes of lifestyle and motivation that we need to reach. However, if we start to delegate authority and responsibility as well as benefit downward to people into viable commons for managing certain natural resources, or start to have infrastructure managed for collective benefit rather than for the corporate owner of important infrastructure, whether it's highways or pipeline or something, or the atmosphere, which is a kind of infrastructure, then we can start to reorient the governance of it. Right now, the governance is managed by the nation state and international bodies, both of which are basically captive to global capitalism and its imperatives. So starting to introduce the commons as a governance framework for all sorts of natural resources is a way to start to change the logic in the way we think about how we our relationship to the resources. So this is obviously is a longer term proposition in a time when we don't have much time. On the other hand, I don't see the current logic yielding the results we need either, and we do need to get out of that rut and start to admit that there's a certain insanity in thinking the old approaches are going to work.
You know, it may sound strange, but researching the commons brought up some strong feelings in me, things I thought I was over. I mean, the fact that the Koch brothers became multi-billionaires with free pollution of our atmosphere, or Tokyo Electric Power Company thinks it's okay to dump tons of radioactivity into our Pacific Ocean, it makes me a little bitter and angry. Do you think the idea of the commons can become emotional for people?
Well, that's the point. People, unlike in a market where you have an impersonal relationship with what's going on, it's just business, impersonal. The commons is about having personal, emotional relationships with the resources that matter to you. And therefore, you protect them more, you defend them more. So it's partly about reintegrating ourselves, for example, with the earth, with that special body of water, with that special mountain range that we hike in. And once we start to have those relationships, I think we start to relate to them in a different way and don't say, oh, well, the EPA will take care of that. No, it's something that we need to start to step up and take care of and find the governance mechanisms to be meaningfully involved. So partly this is about a reorientation of our vision. It's partly also about inventing some new ways of governing and managing these resources than the nation state currently allows.
Let's talk about some of the big voices in the commons movement. Please tell us more about the late Professor Eleanor Ostrom from Indiana University. What did she contribute?
Eleanor Ostrom spent 30 or 40 years studying all sorts of natural resource commons, mostly in rural and developing countries. But she was swimming upstream against the economic orthodoxy of her time because she actually believed that people could self-organize the management of shared resources at a time when economics said that's impossible. Moreover, she was a woman working in a very sexist profession. But in 2009, she became the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in economics for her lifetime of research in this area. And there are now hundreds of scholars around the world who explicitly study commons as commons and why they work and why they don't work on those occasions when they don't. So she was kind of a intellectual vanguard for showing that contrary to conventional economics, this stuff can work. I might add, she won the Nobel Prize the year after the 2008 financial crisis at a time when the Nobel Prize Committee, I suspect, was trying to find alternatives to the standard way of doing things, which is, of course, the quest we're still involved in, is finding the successor to that standard economic approach.
Absolutely. Well, who are a couple of other names that people could look up to find out more about this, other than yourself, of course?
Well, I must say that Europe is far more advanced than those of us in the United States who are interested in the commons, because Italy is extremely advanced in all sorts of experimentation and thinking. I know there's a Belgian fellow who's a colleague of mine, Michel Ballens, who runs something called the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. And he is really quite a pioneer and leading thinker in terms of peer production and digital commons. You know, all sorts of things from not just open source software and wikis, but there's now open source design and production of physical things from cars to furniture and beyond. I have another colleague in Europe, a woman named Silke Helfrich, a German, and Germany is also quite advanced in thinking about the commons, especially in conjunction with the Green Party and the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Spain, Greece, Italy are other areas where there's a lot going on. If you go to my website, bollier.org, B-O-L-L-I-E-R.org, I have a whole blog role which lists the more significant organizations and websites that are involved in this area.
Yeah, your blog goes back to 2004. That's ancient history in the blog world.
Well, it takes a while to develop this alternative perspective, and I've been traveling around amassing this perspective. And I have to say, it's a rather large network that I don't think has been fully acknowledged or recognized by the mainstream. But there's a lot of really interesting experimentation and innovation going on.
All right, let's look at a couple of your books. What can folks expect to find in the 2012 work, The Wealth of the Commons?
Well, this was an attempt by my German colleague Silke Helfrich and I to pull together more than 70 essays by a group of international activists, academics, and project leaders to show just the breadth of activity going on in this area. Many of the essays focus on enclosures of the commons where, for example, mega projects are damming up rivers in Latin America or mining is destroying the environment there. Many of the other essays are focusing on all sorts of creative innovations, such as the city of Linz, Austria, has declared itself an open information commons and has created, for example, free Wi-Fi hotspots and email for all citizens, and all government information is made available under Creative Commons licenses, meaning it can't be privatized, and all sorts of other efforts to try to make information as free and circulating as possible. So that book describes a full range of eclectic, interesting commons projects going on.
You're starting to give me some hope, and I hate it when that happens. So you also co-authored Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons with Professor Burns Weston. The topic's a bit too big for a short radio interview, but we could dig into at least the idea of vernacular law. What is that, and how could that apply to some of the things our listeners might be dreaming of doing?
Well, once again, we've seen the failures of international law and federal law in dealing with many of these problems. We haven't begun to recognize that there's this kind of bottom-up street law of sensibility that needs to be honored and recognized, because I think many of these natural resource commons, for example, are far more ecologically respectful and sustainable than anything the market throws at it. So this kind of socially based law needs to be recognized as a important, powerful force in its own right. And that's what we tried to do in our book, Green Governance, is to show how law, formal law, needs to take greater cognizance of the importance of what we call vernacular law, which is this bottom-up sense of, what shall I say, rules and protocols among people in a commons, how they want to manage the resource. So it's a different way of thinking about how we can manage resources beyond simply bureaucracies and courts, which is not to say it's an either-or proposition. It's more a matter of expanding the scope of what law consists of.
And so your latest book, just out really, is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. What approach do you take there?
Well, this is an attempt to really speak to my mother, to my friends, in a more accessible voice than some of the other things that have been written about the commons, and to explain why this is of importance to ordinary people and citizens in thinking about how we move forward at a time when our political system is in gridlock and dysfunctional, and how the market and the state are essentially in a conspiracy to take over and privatize lots of our shared wealth. So learning how to think like a commoner helps us begin to address that dynamic of what I call the market-state duopoly.
Well, given how embedded most of us are in this market state, I think efforts to build something else are going to be experimental. We don't have a fixed roadmap for where this can go, do we?
No, but that's, of course, precisely the only way that we can get out of our rut that we're in. If we look to the conventional political parties or the political systems, they're not going to give us the kind of innovation we need. I mean, we saw a glimmer of that with Occupy, which, of course, had trouble institutionalizing and advancing its vision in a more continuous way. I think the commons is a way for us to conceptualize it. It gives us a whole body of historical precedents to draw upon, a whole body of political precedents to guide us in how we can engage. And as I say, globally, there's many, many projects that are starting to federate and cooperate with each other, especially in Europe and the global south, which are a new source of solidarity. And I think for Americans who are a bit behind the curve on this, a source of inspiration as well.
Listeners, I think David Bollier's website is an excellent place to start if you want to know more. He's got some short introductions there, some links to videos, podcasts, free podcasts, blog articles, the works. You can find that at bollier.org, as he says, B-O-L-L-I-E-R.org. And I'll be putting a bunch of links that I hope will help you in my own weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Let's find out what we have in common and build on that. David, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.